David Ambrose describes his life growing up as navigating on a live wire with his mother's mental illness. His new memoir, A Place Called Home, chronicles his journey through profound poverty and homelessness, the assaults of the foster care system, and the battles he fought to find his way home to himself. His memoir and his life are a manifesto of survival and a call for us to move from empathy to action. Hello and welcome to At the Podium with me, Patrick Huey. At the Podium is a multimedia platform that brings together people from a diverse background of lives, careers, and experiences who all share one thing in common. They have stepped fully into the transformative power of finding and raising their voices to make an impact on the world we live in today. At the Podium holds a space for everyone to share their stories, to be heard, and to bring us inspiration. Today, I'm thrilled to share the podium with David Ambrose. David Ambrose is a national poverty and child welfare expert and advocate. He was recognized by President Barack Obama as an American champion of change. Currently serving as the head of Community Engagement West for Amazon, Ambrose previously led corporate social responsibility for Walt Disney Television and has served as president of the Los Angeles City Planning Commission, as well as a California Child Welfare Council member. After growing up homeless and then in foster care, he graduated from Vassar College and later earned his JD from UCLA School of Law. He is a foster dad and lives in Los Angeles, California. Before we hear from David today, I want to invite you to share At the Podium with the people in your lives. If you find our conversation today helpful, and I hope that you will, take a screenshot and share on your Instagram and tag @thepodium_PatrickHuey. Or if you're on LinkedIn or Facebook, share our links there. Your shares, likes, and 5-star written reviews help grow our audience and move us up the charts. I'm grateful for your support in this capacity. Okay, David, welcome to At the Podium.
Oh my gosh, that intro. I feel like I should turn around and find the right person you're trying to talk to. I guess that's me. Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is you. It is you, David. And first of all, thank you for being here. And I just want to say thank you for the conversation we're going to have today. And thank you for writing this beautiful and sometimes deeply painful memoir about your life called A Place Called Home. And the book is actually available today for people to purchase. So our timing could not have been better. David, it was one of the most profound, most important books that I've read in quite some time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you.
It was more than a memoir. It was a call to action against poverty, against homelessness, against hopelessness.
Yes.
And it really is a manifesto of survival and self-ownership in a foster care system that is oftentimes designed to keep brutalized children locked in what I describe as generational scarcity and violence.
Mm. Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. That's exactly why I wrote it. I think we have this learned helplessness that we can't do big things or fix things. And that's even worse when people need us to throw them a lifeline. I don't understand it, and I refuse to accept it. I think about a country that sent a person to the moon. We should not have homeless children or homeless families or struggling families or violence in state facilities that house children. We just won't and can't, and we shouldn't, and I won't let it happen for another generation.
What you describe is really encapsulated in the first couple of paragraphs of the book, which I'm going to read, not the whole 2 paragraphs, but a section of it. When we first meet you in the book, you're 5 years old. It's almost the night before Christmas, and you and your family are wandering the streets of Manhattan and you're homeless. And you write of this time, you say, on the fringes of this shiny holiday wonderland, in the dark alcoves and corners of the night, are people like us, passing like ghosts around and through the bright, clean tourists. We drift in circles, making our home everywhere and nowhere. We hunker down in the colorless crevices of the city, in the gray shadows of gray buildings where the gray snow is piled. We are great people fading to nothing. Our homelessness stretches on forever in all directions, a bus station, a subway car, a shelter, a hospital waiting room, a Bowery slum. We are disappearing into ghosts. We've done this before, walked with mom all night. We've never had a place to call home, never stayed in one place long enough for me to remember it. But for the first time in my life, though I don't have the words for it, I think we might die.
Wow. I don't think I've ever heard anyone read those aloud. Yeah.
I mean, David, what you're describing here is a profound poverty. It's not Oliver Twist. It's not a Hollywood version of what being homeless and living in poverty is like. You're describing a profound poverty that is incessant in your life. Yes. How did your family find themselves in this really dangerous situation?
I think if we look around ourselves today, you will see homeless children and homeless families in these same spaces. Yeah. And the ways that we get there are the same ways that my family got there. We have taken a machete to the social welfare safety net, and then we're shocked when people fall through the gaping holes. We've shamed people with mental illness, which is starting to turn around, but still has so much farther to go. And my mom suffered profound mental illness. And through that gaping hole of the social welfare safety net, a woman and three children found herself on the streets. And we stayed there for 11 years. I think when I look around and when I'm active today, I see the same issues and the same pathways that families so easily inherit poverty and violence. And poverty is one of the most pernicious things in our society. We have a lot of shame about talking about a lot of things. And I think poverty is high on that list. Mm-hmm. My family stayed there for more than a decade, more than two decades. And when I got out of foster care, just flash forward a little bit, it's where I found my mom again, homeless. I think we might have stayed there forever and not necessarily made it out alive, but we did. And it was through a unique set of circumstances that we could talk about. But for most of my early childhood, my mom had a mental illness that was progressively getting worse. And that led the three of us, her children, to suffer alongside with her.
It's almost like you three were mentally ill also, because she was. You couldn't have a whatever normal means, but a normal existence, because she couldn't have a normal existence. And the system did not seem able to respond to that.
You know that phrase, we are Soylent Green? There has been such a knockdown of government. And what I'm always struck by is the way that I start my advocacy with folks is, we have the best system ever invented in our country right now. And there's so much work we need to do, but there's good things happening. Mental illness, the kids that are affected by it in terms of their family members, is an untreated pandemic. Mm-hmm. So many people and so many families have someone within there, even families with homes, that are touched by this. And it is near impossible for us to help those family members. And when you're reliant on one human to guide you through this world, it becomes just an impossible task every single moment of the day to figure out the way forward. The three of us navigated on a live wire with my mother. We never knew what was going to come. And all around us were others. I remember it was the 80s. It was a very different New York City. Some listening might remember, it was not the playground that it is today. All around us were folks dying of AIDS. We had Vietnam vets everywhere. We had so many people disregarded by society. And that's where we found ourselves, collected with them in the gutters. And you had to fight to survive. And that's what the three of us did, the three children of my mom. And we tried to help my mom along the way.
There are two moments in the book that stick out to me, thinking about what you and your siblings went through in terms of this real, as you describe it, fight and struggle to survive with your mom. There were two moments. It was the moment in the book where you go into the Wendy's bathroom and you lock the door and you empty out the clothes, the few pieces of clothing that you as a family had, and you're in the sink washing the clothes. And you talk about how when you open the bag, you can't, like the smell of the clothes that you guys had been wearing sort of just hits you because it's been sort of just held in that one small space, and you're in that sink and you're hoping no one comes in because that's the only way you know how to wash your clothes. Mm-hmm. And then there's the moment when you're, and you go through a series of schools and in and out of schools, which you chronicle in the book, but you're sitting at the desk and you describe the lice just jumping off of your hair onto the desk and you're just smashing them down. Where do you as a 10-year-old even find the capacity within yourself to move through that and not just give up hope? Because you never give up hope in the book.
I don't know if I would have made it if I gave up hope at any point in my life. It doesn't mean I didn't struggle or get low, but the human condition of folks that we stare past and look past and avert our gaze is a shame. It's a moral shame on our country. People in abject poverty that need our help, children, families, hell, men, God help us, need our help. Yeah. And as a child walking around bedraggled and covered in filth, I constantly was reminded how disgusting I was by the looks or the avoidance of people's look at me. I started this book, and one of the things I did was I wrote a list of 10 tips to survive homelessness for a child. And I did that because I kept coming across these moments where I was like, oh yeah, that's how we did that. That's how we survived. And some of them made it into the book as stories. But doing laundry in public places, I'm sure many of us have seen it. You know, walked in and out of a bathroom at a Greyhound bus station or the airport waiting area outside the security back in the day. My family lived in these corners. We had to make do. The luxury of giving up was not something I could afford. We had to do these things. We had to find the next meal. And that sometimes meant stealing. That sometimes meant conniving our way. There's grocery stores in New York where you could get a sample of deli meat. And so we would go to 5 or 6 grocery stores and we'd like, oh, can we try a slice of turkey? You know, a little slice, a little thicker, maybe a little thicker. And then, I don't think we're going to get that. You had to find ways to survive. And that's what my family did. And for me as a child, that meant that I had to do things that I don't think most children should do. But the other thing I would say about children is children are incredibly resilient. Mm-hmm. And these things that we think of as curses can become blessings. And that many of the skills that I learned have served me into my adulthood. I don't do my laundry in sinks anymore, but I know that I could. So when people are worried or freaked out about whatever, I am very grounded in what it means to be at the bottom. I don't necessarily lose my mind over certain things. I understand what it means to fall out of society, which is something we can all survive, but we shouldn't have children there and families. You can't have a healthy child if you don't have a healthy family. The family can't be healthy if the communities are impoverished, either with opportunity or with resources. So it's a whole ecosystem. So when I say the child, I mean the whole system mm-hmm. that wraps their arm around it. One of the most burnt moments of shame in my life is also in the book, where that woman at story time when I was a child stands in front of me, just towers over me. And I'm sitting next to her son, and we've been homeless for a while. And she yells at me to move away from her child. And I understand. I mean, many people listening would not want me in that moment when I was a child, covered in filth, probably lice, sitting next to your child.
Yeah.
She could have handled it better. And I just remember being so mortified and embarrassed and hungry and tired and scared. And I think I was 6 or 7. I don't know the exact age.
You know, we're having this conversation in the country right now about life, and not just about the abortion issue, but about Black lives, about all lives. and whose life matters and whose life doesn't matter. And right now we're in a moment where we have a strong preoccupation with the life in the womb. And I think what you just said really highlights that we need to have as much compassion and as much advocacy and agency around the life once it's outside of the womb, particularly for people who, through no fault of their own, have fallen through the cracks of a social safety net that has been fraying for decades, and that it's politically been sacrificed for a bridge in a town or for a trip to the moon or for X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. You know, I said about government, we are the government. Government is a description of the sandbox that we get to interact with each other in. We have complete agency every year to change what we value and what we support. I am constantly struck by that ability, which is a damn miracle that we get to invent the world we want to live in. And I don't want to live in the world with families that struggle, with children that suffer. And I don't have to. You don't have to. We don't have to. If anyone's been to Los Angeles, there's such a common moment when there's a car accident on the side of the freeway, which causes traffic to snarl. And you have two emotions when that happens. One, you really do hope everyone's okay. And two, you're pissed off that they're slowing down traffic and probably, you know, were on their phone or something. You're angry. The car accident on the side of the road is the condition of American families and children. And no one is getting out of their car to do anything. We're like, oh, that's so sad. And I'm sure someone's going to do something. We are that someone. And I truly believe we can do that. I ask people constantly when I talk to in public or in other venues to close their eyes and imagine if they had to put their child in foster care or in a shelter. What does that look like? And when your eyes are closed, I can't see your political party color. Can't see it. Two of the most important bills on foster care were signed by two very different presidents, President Clinton and President Trump. Children, regardless of how they become children, should be a very big cause for concern for all of us, especially those that without the resources to thrive or survive. And I think we have proven that we can do things, big things. And it's on all of us. You may not be able to save the world, but you can care. And we can talk about some of the ways people can get active. But I remain terribly optimistic about our ability. My life is impossible. And yet here I am sitting with you talking about a memoir that I published. That's insane.
Yeah.
And yet here we are.
You just mentioned the car accident in LA. I was in LA just last week and I was driving up La Cienega. Driving north on La Cienega, there I am in the shadow of the Beverly Center. And to my left, to the west, is Beverly Hills. And straight ahead are the Hollywood Hills. And they're literally homeless encampments just scattered throughout there. And no one's paying attention. No one's even looking. And it thinking about that in context with your book, it made understand the invisibility of homelessness, how you, as a child in the book, you guys are in Grand Central, you're trying to get money to buy your mom cigarettes so that she won't beat you. The passersby just keep moving. No one stops. No one looks. No one says, is this little 7-year-old child okay? And what is that thing within us that makes us drive by the car accident, that makes us see a child clearly in extreme circumstances, see hundreds of people living on the streets, and we don't do anything?
Two couple things I want to unpack that. It's a learned helplessness and it's self-protection. It is emotionally overwhelming to begin to think about the condition of those people as you go about your life. And it feels overwhelming. It just feels like, what can I do? And so you look away, you know, you open up your social media app and you stroll through beautiful pictures of people that you know, and you soothe oneself. I understand that. I do it too. The other reality is we are making big progress in this issue in Los Angeles. And that's why I think it's important as an advocate. And I always start with the optimism because it's true. We have housed more people in LA in the last 10 years than we did in the previous 30.
Mm.
We're making progress. We've taxed ourselves to build housing. Constantly, we need to improve. We need to do more. We need to make those dollars work harder, but we're making steps. And if we keep believing that we're not, then we're never going to even start to do the hard work that we need to do. I think it's self-protection. But once you begin to engage with the topic and you realize the largest percentage of the homeless in LA and major American cities are former foster kids, 30 to 40%. We're emancipating, which is the word, what it's called when you leave foster care, kids into homelessness out of the system. More foster kids will go to jail than will go to college. They are the people living in those tents by the Beverly Center. We can do better. And we have. We just need to keep improving and we need to look at it square on. And if you can't become a savior for that one individual in that tent, that's fine. The question is not what you can't do. The question is, what can you do? And we should talk about that. There's a lot you can do aside from try and save the world. There are options that you have as an individual to have agency, to believe that you can actually contribute to make that situation better.
What are those things?
It's going to be really dependent on the individual. So my website, davidambrose.com, it links to one of my activist pages. There's a column called Activism. And I created this nonprofit called Fostermore. And the idea was, how do we get everybody to contribute to the solution? First of all, we have to stop making foster care and adoption so darn dark.
Yeah.
Sounds so depressing. So much like breast cancer 30 years ago, from then to today, I wanted to take foster care away from the racism, classism, sexism, into a place of hope and optimism. But the other key part of Fostermore was, what if you can't foster? It just feels like you can't do anything. That's not true. And so I created what I call a buffet of engagement. When you go to a buffet, you don't have to take every item there. You may just want one piece of broccoli and all of the chicken tenders. I completely respect that. I'm with you. But you can still take a piece of the broccoli. So if you go to the site, there's all different options in your local community you can link to. One national campaign that I'm operating right now is called Donate Your Small Talk. What? Donate Your Small Talk is a very simple idea. Everyone kept telling me, well, I can't, and they would insert. Everyone can donate their small talk. When you ask somebody how their weekend was, how are their kids, what did you do over the holiday, no one actually cares. It's just verbal filler. What if we took those 30 seconds of words and said, hey, did you know Marilyn Monroe was a foster kid? Hey, did you know Steve Jobs was adopted out of foster care? Isn't that wild?
Mm-hmm.
Fun facts. Willie Nelson. So we try to create fun facts that folks could share with each other. And some are serious. 700 kids enter the system every day. So you can donate your small talk. And then the ladder and the buffet goes up. So all of us can do something. And that's what we try to create as an opportunity in the community. I hope a large number of people do foster. But don't feel like it's all or nothing. There are middle steps that you can take. It's as simple sometimes as your words.
There's a great moment in the book, speaking of a buffet, when you and your siblings, Alex and Jessica, I think you go to Ponderosa.
Ponderosa.
And you're waiting outside for a family to leave so that you can rush into their table before the host or the server, if their server's there, realize that there's been a switch because no one's really paying attention. Which is kind of a metaphor for the world right now around no one's just paying attention. And you guys are like literally sitting there scarfing down all the food at the buffet of the Ponderosa. But it's really a beautiful moment because the manager realizes what's happening and she doesn't shoo you out. She really becomes one of the really beautiful lights for you all in the story.
Absolutely.
And even as dark as the story in some places becomes, you talk about that hope in these amazing people who are there for you,
mm-hmm.
who support you. I'm thinking about your trip to Spain. I'm even thinking about Mel, who I want to talk about in a minute, because I think that relationship in the book is quite beautiful.
But yeah, I love that. I like you picked up on that. I call them occasional angels. It's like you're drowning and someone pulls you up just long enough to gulp air.
Yeah.
And that sustains you for just a bit more. And that's what I think is beautiful about us all having the ability to do something, which we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That individual was not going to foster that manager, but she benignly as the manager looked the other way while a starving family stuffed their face and then ushered us out. There are so many moments that I write about where an occasional angel intervened in many different ways. Sometimes teachers would sneak a candy bar into our bag, or a church let us sleep in a linen closet when it got particularly cold outside. And you go like, well, why didn't they help you find a place? Because they didn't. But that linen closet was warm and we slept there and that was okay. And there's one particular occasional angel, Holly. I volunteered at the YMCA and it was really to get out of this really terribly abusive foster home. And this woman saw what was going on and she fought for almost 2 years to get me. She wasn't a foster parent. Her and her husband, Steve, fought to get me. Some working class family with not a lot of resources. And that was the occasional angel. We can all be occasional angels. And I truly believe that. And I try and model it in my own life, but we're imperfect. It's something you don't have to be an angel. You can sometimes just do something. But yeah, I remember that Ponderosa very well.
Holly and Steve are an amazing arc in the book and in your story. But I do want to talk about your mother, because I think she's a very controversial figure in the book. You describe her as someone who threw you overboard and at the same time threw you a lifeline. And when you and I spoke prior to this call, you talked about some of the very negative words and negative energy that are being hurled at your mother right now from readers of the book. Were you, as a writer and a son, prepared for the amount of anger that was going to be expressed towards your mother as you were writing this book?
There's so many characters in this book that deserve our condemnation. Mm-hmm. My mother is not one of them. I love my mother. I care for my mother today. My mom, if she had cancer, would be beloved by us. We would champion her and rally for her and try and encourage her to get through it, Mary. My mom is sick. And while I don't love the life that we had or the things that she did, and I see them square on, my mom is sick. And I have, maybe it's a coping mechanism, but it's also something I intellectually understand. How do you condemn someone for being sick? My mom has been in a prison for almost 80 years. And it's a prison of fear and delusion. She's never let out. There's no time when she gets to relieve the pressure she's under. And thankfully, we've started to take this seriously in this country, and we're having a conversation around mental illness. But what I hope people walk away from is not that I would ever want my mother hurt or in any way yelled at. What I want is for you to look in the mirror and ask yourself, what can I do to help somebody like David? Mm-hmm. What can I do in my community? What's going on in mental health in my area? Save that energy and channel it into do something. I knew that people would have strong reactions to my mom because the stories that I share, I understand it. Believe me, I'm in my early middle age, I'll say, and I've had to learn to come to this place where I'm at. But I hope people, instead of pointing fingers and yelling, ask themselves in the mirror and point that finger and say, what have I done to help people like this boy in this book? I have this image and it's always been with me. I don't know my mother, in that I don't know who she would have been. And I've always prayed that I could have a conversation with my mom for an hour. Just this person that's underneath all that. And I've always thought about like this image, and it's a little ethereal, but it's really the image I have, which is like the hand of God or the universe, whatever your beliefs, just like on that my mom's head. And through that touch, she's able to just have some relief. And I get to talk to this person that's in there, that I know is in there, that I glimpse, and I share those stories in the book. I glimpse who she would have been without this illness. And I just want to talk to her. I want to learn about her. I want to ask her questions and just tell her about myself and be with my mother. I love my mom. I've been caring for her for my entire adult life. And I hope people will come to love her as much as I do, as hard as it is to love. Love, as I've learned, including self-love, is a discipline. You must practice it, much like yoga. In order to maximize your flexibility, you have to be able to practice it. And my mom is my hardest practice and makes me, I think, the person that I am.
You never curse her in the book. Despite all that happens between the two of you, you never curse her. There's an interesting thing that happens in the book. You say that you've been taking care of your mother your whole adult life, and you really have been taking care of her your whole life, because there is a real arc in the book that you, even in that first scene of the book, when you are wandering the streets of Manhattan, you're the one who's sort of guiding the conversation, not Jessica, not Alex, not your mother, but you're the one who is somehow driving through the fog and the haze of her mental illness to try to get to that place where you guys finally end up. But you've always been doing that your whole life. And I didn't really have a conception of you as a child in the book until the moment, which is probably one of the few times in the book where I actually broke down and wept, was when you had called all these different agencies and services, and you couldn't call because you didn't have cell phones back then, but you had somehow through your school alerted the agencies to what was really happening within the home. And they finally show up and Mel comes into the house and she finds you. I think you're just like in your underwear, you're hiding in your sister's room by a lazy boy that you guys had found on the street and brought into the house. And the way you write it, David, the way you describe it, made me realize two things. It made me realize the trapped nature of the life that you were living. It encapsulated the violence you had been living with. And for the first time in the book, I was like, he's a child. He's literally 12. And there was something about that moment when she comes through the door, when Mel comes through the door to find you and take you out. And we think, thank God, she's finally there. But they drop you into another place of hell at the juvenile detention center. But I just thought, how do you find a way to forgive the mother who put you in that situation, understanding all of the circumstances of her life,
yeah,
the prison that she is in? And have you been able to really forgive her?
I absolutely have. And no matter what punishment we might mete out, she's experienced something much worse.
Yeah.
I hope everyone listens to this podcast, learns a little bit more about mental health. But my mom, and I'm not going to share her diagnosis, but my mom is in a prison. And I can't imagine a worse thing than 80 years of sustained fear, profound fear and delusion. I just can't imagine. And that is much worse than anything I could ever ask for or would want. And the other piece, honestly, is it was at first a necessity. Because this woman, at the one hand, was my worst punisher for nothing. And on the other hand, the only way that I was able to survive. I did not have the knowledge or coping or skills or legal rights to do things. And so this woman was both my jailer and the woman that kept me alive.
Mm.
Despite everything, I did not know how to do things. And so she was both. And I'll tell you, when I went into foster care, with the one exception, I went into a system that punished me equally, if not worse, but didn't love me. And my mom loved me. Mm-hmm. Her three children have advanced degrees, healthy families, and successful lives by every external metric. How is that? And that's my mom. My mom is a woman of many contradictions, but I am an agent for change and have the life that I have today because of this person. And I love my life. I love who I've become. And I love the people in my life. So did I want that life? Absolutely not. Would I change it? Absolutely not. Nothing I could do would be worse than my mother's already suffered. I had to forgive in order to survive. And in my older age, I realized how blessed I am to be where I'm at. And that's because of the life that I led.
You write of the foster system, and I'm going to read it. Your writing is so beautiful. When people read this book, they're going to be, I think what makes the story really bearable to read is how you've constructed the story, and that you've really allowed the poetry of the writing to sort of soothe the horror and the darkness of the experience. But I love that you said you wouldn't change your experience. I think it was Maya Angelou, who I don't quote very often, who said, I wouldn't change my journey for anything, or I wouldn't change my journey now. But the journey is what both of our journeys brought us to this moment at 8 a.m. today. Having this conversation. And but for our
That's
journey,
right.
but for our journeys, we wouldn't be here, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But you write of the foster care system, and I have to read it because you write it better than I could ever sort of distill it down. You say, we remove kids from unsafe situations without hope. Then we put them in a system that further destroys them. Many of them will serve time in juvenile prisons and then be sent back into the streets, still deprived, abused, assaulted, and missing school with a lack of care and adult supervision. They'll return to juvenile detention for the same petty thievery and other crimes, and it will escalate. There's no one to save or stop them, to hug and nurture them. Then we're shocked when at 18, they're in poverty, just like their parents. If we tried, we couldn't design a more perfect system to perpetuate violence, poverty, and racism. This governmental structure functions as a pipeline to prison. As you described it, as you have interfaced with it, can the foster care system be saved?
Oof. It's so weird to hear your own words. Yes. That's a particularly dark moment, but I know it can be. I know it can be. My sister is a social worker for many years. Mm-hmm. I am an advocate and deeply involved. It absolutely can be, because it must be. What else are we going to do? There are children that need to be removed from their families. That is an awesome and violent power that we give the government that is absolutely necessary. But 2/3 of the children entering foster care are there for neglect, which is a euphemism for poverty, which is a euphemism for racism and classism. We can keep those 2/3 out of the system by helping their families. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars to care for a kid in foster care. If mom or dad or mom or dad and dad need a job or help or mental health care or a bus pass or rent for a month, why don't we preserve that family and keep those 2/3 from coming in the system and being ground down? And then we could focus our energy, our love and attention on those children that really need to be in the system. My afterword of the book is a prescription for policy on what we can do. And I encourage readers, once you get through the story, to read it and ask their elected people to do these things. There are simple solutions, and we're doing it. You may be familiar with Congresswoman Karen Bass, who's running for mayor here in Los Angeles and is going to win. A lot of foster kids call her Moses.
Yeah.
Because of the policies and the congressional committee she founded on foster care and adoption. She's not sitting on the sidelines. She saw back when she started her advocacy stuff that was going on in her community. And from that nonprofit, she went on to run for office and is now, in my opinion, going to run one of the most important cities in the world. People have agency and power to do something. And if you're not sure what to do, find people that are and lean in and help them. Mm. So yes, I absolutely believe we can fix the system. I said it earlier, we have the best system ever invented right now. It's the most aware, transparent, and we can still do better. And I truly believe that for the first time ever right now, President Trump signed a bill allowing states to use money to preserve families, to prevent the need for foster care. Mm. It was buried in another bill, but it's now the law. And states can opt in to do that work. Everyone's like, well, that's so technical. Yes, because policymaking is technical, which is why we should hire experts, not celebrities. But we can all do something. I am so bullish on it, which is why I wrote the book in the first place. Inspire people with my story. Show the most vulnerable part of my soul so that you feel something. Big feels.
I love
to motivate you to go do something. And that something has to be to fix the system. We cannot give up on it. Giving up on it means more homeless children. It's more women struggling. It's more people with mental health dying every day on the streets of this country. We simply cannot give up. We cannot, and I won't.
There's a point in the book where the social workers come to your house. Your mom is in the same room with you. You're there. And they start asking you in front of her about the abuse you've suffered at her hands. And I thought, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? And I'm obviously, then there may be reasons and laws that govern that kind of interaction. But to me, it seemed like the most defeating thing to do is to question the victim in front of the abuser.
I appreciate you pointing that out, but I would just note there's so many moments like that. There's a moment in the book where my mom, we're in court being evicted.
Yep.
And I'm facing a judge who's telling a woman and three children they're going to go live on the street now. How is that any different? You're a person in state power condemning this family to potential death so casually and over a couple hundred dollars. There's so many moments that we interact with actors that have the power or decide not to use it to help or hurt my family or myself. We are so ready to question the motives of foster parents or the failures of social workers. But we never ask ourselves tough questions. We never ask ourselves, what have I done? What can I do? What might I do? Absolutely should not have happened. And yet here I am telling the story. But I want us to put down the pitchforks, pick up the internet, and find out what you can do, because that absolutely should not have happened. When you underfund a system and overtax these social workers with too many kids, and we underpay them so they churn through and they have to have master's degrees, what do we think is going to happen? Yeah. When you drive a car with no engine, it doesn't go very far. You're not shocked by that fact, but we have murdered this system. And then we're shocked when people who are doing their damnedest to get through the day to do their jobs fail at it. And then we create more laws and policy that make their lives a living hell. We can do better. Why don't we fully fund the system to support social workers so that they know and can have enough time in their day to separate us before they do an inquisition of the child that's reported abuse in front of the abuser? Of course, that doesn't make any sense. I have no idea why that happened. I'm certain it was not what they were supposed to do. But I also looked at this human who's sitting across who probably had 50 visits to do that week. Oh. Can you imagine the emotional toll? She's just trying to get through her day. And she took a shortcut that was very dangerous. I don't condemn her. I don't like it. But what do we expect as a society? We can support that social worker. I've always thought about this. Like my sister, I asked her one time, like, what's social work like? And she's like, paperwork. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, I don't do social work. I do paperwork. Mm. Every time there's a lawsuit, I have another form I have to fill out. And I just thought that was such a profound thing to say. She said, I had this number of kids in my case, but when I go into a home to look, every kid in that home is my responsibility. So you think I have 15, 20 kids? I have 40. Yeah. Because I have to look at every single kid's well-being. And so when we have these people in the system that are acting a certain way, we should condemn that. But then we should ask the harder question is, how did that symptom come from? What illness? And the illnesses, we've underfunded our systems.
How are Alex and Jessica?
Everyone's happy and healthy. And my brother, when we left foster care, joined the military and served overseas. And that was really hard, as you might imagine, the last 20 years we've had. And then went into banking. My sister went to graduate school out here and became a social worker and was a social worker for many years. She's now in the school system doing similar work. We're completely connected. We talk all the time. We're mostly focused on the kind of small things, small joys, small challenges of the day. Like all of us, when we talk to our family are like, I was texting with my sister before this and I said, what are you excited about today? That's what I texted her. And she said, my boys. And I went back, wah, wah, because she truly is. And she goes, what about you? And I said that I don't have to share my pot of coffee anymore. So I have a full pot of coffee for myself. What a place for the kids that you read about to be in, that my sister is happy about her boys and going to work and living her life. And I am like thrilled to be talking to you with my 22 ounces of coffee. Don't tell anyone. It's a joy. I love them so much. And I'm so lucky that they're in my life. They're my left and my right. Mm. And I think about all of us would not be where we are without each other, which is something that we don't really talk about in the book, which is the preservation of sibling sets. They separate them, not because they want to, but because it's hard to find homes that'll take that many children. And we were separated. And that was, for many reasons, brutal.
But I'll tell you, again, in the book, your character, and I don't mean the I mean, your internal character shines through. Yeah. Even when Alex and Jessica voted for themselves and got out of that home,
yeah,
and left you behind, you were still able to, in the moment of being a 13, 12-year-old person, you understood why they did that. And you were even in that moment able to forgive them for leaving you there with those people who you were with.
Absolutely. Any one of these assaults on my humanity could have defeated me. And if you live in them, you become the hundreds of siblings that I had in foster care. I don't even remember all their names. Hundreds. They got stuck in whatever indignity or violence or deprivation was thrust on them as children. Any single one of these things that I talk about in the book could have defeated me. And I had to learn to not let it. I had to learn to trim my sails and move through the hurricane. And there's different ways that I did that. I perhaps am too forgiving, but it makes me the hopeful, pragmatic optimist that I am today to believe that we can do better. I dedicate the book to my mom and my brother and sister. And about my mom, I say in the first pages, there's three things I want to talk about in the first couple of pages. One is to my mother, who taught me to forgive and to do one impossible thing at a time, which is what you're talking about. Because forgiveness is so hard and it's not one and done. And the other, if you didn't know, there's a Latin, illegitimi non caberendum, which is the words, I forgot what the page is called in a book. That means don't let the bastards grind you down in Latin. And that has been my life's motto my whole life. And bastards sometimes are not people, but circumstances. And I refuse. I refuse. I will not become numb. I will not become a pessimist. I will continue to believe that we can make the world a better place. People in my life that I love are imperfect, as am I. But we can all strive to be better towards each other, the planet, and perfect strangers.
What do you keep, what's still with you from that time in your life that you write about?
Oh my gosh, it's such a good question. Well, I'll give you an analogy that I've had to, or metaphor. You'll tell me, I can't remember which it is. I early on, and really the moment when I went into that first juvenile group home, was very violent, and in many ways. And I remember that story I tell in the book, that is the last time I cried when I was 12 years old until I was 37. I felt so strongly that if I showed any more weakness, it would get me killed. And I don't mean that euphemistically. I meant, I really thought me being the weakling would set me out in this jail-like facility for something that could kill me. And I had just come from a situation where I nearly died at the hands of my mother. Death was a real thing. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to kill me. So I put that all out, snuffed it all out. And I started taking all the assaults, and I mean that in every sense of the word, and I would put them in clear plastic bins. And I would label the bin, and then I would put it in my Dewey Decimal System card catalog. Because I never denied what was going on, and I knew what was going on, but I didn't have to feel what was going on. Mm. And that worked for 20 plus years. And then in my mid late 30s, my shelf broke and all of those boxes came tumbling down, and my coping mechanism no longer existed to put things on the shelf. I had to learn a different way. And the book is part of that process to share my story, to say, hey, these things really happened. This is how I feel about them. And I cry now too all the time. I mean, which is shocking. I've gone from 0 to 60 in no time at all. Hmm. And I'm no longer numb. I live to the full. I have the full range of life experiences, and I sense them, and I share that with people, and I'm able to bond more deeply. What do I take from that? Everything and nothing. Otherwise, I'd lose my mind.
I think part of what makes the book so powerful, and I think why the book will have the effect that I think you want it to have, is because we all live with those things that we put in boxes and label and put them on a shelf. We all live with maybe not the shame of poverty, but we definitely live with the poverty of emotion, the deficits of love. We all live with that, the shames that we've experienced. And the book requires that we acknowledge it and we try to move through it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was your intent.
Absolutely. It's to move people from that place of empathy and pity or sadness, which you should have all those feelings, to action. The beautiful thing about our world that I love every day is we are creating the world we live in. I think about that moment you referenced earlier, which we kind of went through quickly, but when I don't know the age because I don't have a photo album. I didn't graduate school that year. I have no idea how old I was, somewhere between 4 and 7. And I was begging on Grand Central on the concourse, and up ahead of me, 4 feet ahead of me, the men, because it was mostly men in the early 80s, opened up because I was filthy and I smelled, I was disgusting. And I had this moment right then, I was like, hey, I need to raise money. I need to get money because my mom, she's going to need it to get cigarettes. But also I thought to myself, my God, we're not part of this world. And today I would say for all the listeners that I felt like I was unplugged from the matrix. And it has always stayed with me that this thing we operate in is a collective delusion called society and reality. We get to program that reality. And we choose to have a reality at the moment with these problems, but we can choose a different reality. And the way that manifests in each of our individual lives is going to be up to you. Some people may be able to do a lot or little today, tomorrow, but all of us can do something. And I strongly believe in the agency of the individual, the power of each of us to do that something, even if it's just to care enough to learn a little bit and talk about the issues instead of the latest, most interesting cat video, of which I love to.
What in your life has been the biggest leap of faith that you've had to make?
Wow. Oh, gosh. We could talk about putting myself into foster care, which I did, which was uninformed. When I left foster care, I sort of committed fraud on a grant application, on an exchange program, and I moved to Spain at 17 after committing fraud on the court as well by lying about who my father was. I mean, it's, my gosh. I mean, I hope no one in the government or police are listening to this or read the book, Life of Crime, it should have been called. That is certainly one of the biggest leaps of faith that I've ever done. But there's all these moments in our lives when we make these decisions. I mean, jumping back into foster care when May wanted me to go back downstairs and not go to school. That was her punishment. And I remember, you know, they talk about touching the third rail of politics, right? Like Social Security, you know. And for listeners not from New York City, when you touch the third rail in the city of the subways, you get electrocuted. That's why it's called that. I felt like I touched the third rail of the universe in that moment. Like I connected to meaning and self-power. When I turned around, I'm like, hell no, I am done. And I'll tell you, after that moment, no one ever hit me again. I walked out that door of that foster home and I told her to go, mm-hmm. And I walked to school and I said, I'm not going back there. And that was one of the most abusive foster homes I was ever in. That moment of taking agency and realizing that I was my own jailkeeper and I could live differently was this profound leap of faith. Profound. But I honestly believe that they don't have to be that dramatic. You know, they don't have to be that dramatic. Taking the risk to write this book, I have to tell you, I haven't shared these stories even with my siblings. I had to like well-arm them to read this book. And that was incredible. I mean, they didn't know some of these stories because we weren't together. A huge leap of faith for me in the belief of the common decency of everyone that we are going to read this and we're not going to stand for it. And we're going to make sure that kids today have a better outcome and a better experience and a little bit less of a abrasive path to get here.
David, this season of the show, I'm curious about the voice and people who have found their voice. I feel like you have found your voice. That may or may not be your perception of it. But I ask you, have you found your voice? And if you have, what do you want to say with this huge platform that you have and that you are building?
Well, it's my core belief about the goodness of all of us that has to meet the other belief that I have, which is we each individually are the change that we're waiting for. And the marriage of those two things is so powerful. It's unstoppable. And I want people to hear my voice and ask themselves every single day, what can I do? And it doesn't mean you have to solve the hardest problems, but what can you do? I'm constantly struck in Los Angeles when people complain about homelessness. And two things bother me when they say clean it up, because I once was that it. The other thing is the lack of understanding of who has the budget, power, and authority to deal with homelessness. They're screaming at the mayor, and the mayor doesn't have the authority. It's the county supervisors. We have to become sophisticated consumers of our government, not just rant, but spend the time and energy. If you can figure out an iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy, you can figure out how to log into a school board meeting and ask tough questions. I want us to believe in the agency of us to work together to do big things. And that is only individually if we each contribute something to that part. It's those two things. I want to inspire us as individuals to move from empathy to action. That is, it's kind of my phrase for a reason, because I think a lot of us are good people. It needs to be married with that other part of the equation, which is, what can I do? Go find out. I'll help.
David, thank you so much for your time today. And I'm so honored that you sat down with me to talk about this book. I'm so grateful to you for surviving.
Thank you. And I loved your intro. I am a fan, and thank you for the conversation. I hope everyone today does ask themselves, what can they do besides download the podcast and become a super fan and share it with others? Read the book, go to the website, find out, ask the question, get involved.
Read the book. It's available today. And to those of you who are watching or listening, remember, we all have a voice. So use yours wisely. Bye, everyone. Thank you, David.